Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi, the show that explores the methods and patterns of U.S. foreign policy all around the world and the history that reverberates in our lives today. This week, we'll examine Latin America. America's neighbors to the south have taken center stage in U.S. domestic politics, whether Democrats and Republicans sparring over the Mexican border, or Presidents Biden and Donald Trump, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi recognizing Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela. The U.S. has a lot of cleanup ahead with its southern neighbors. Then, as the U.S. is preoccupied with a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, China and Russia are making moves across Latin America. The two BRICS giants aiming to add a new South American ally to the roster and broker business deals, embracing the left turn that Latin America is taking. Will this cause a hemispheric shift? All right, it's time to get into the MO. Luis Inácio da Silva, better known simply as Lula, Brazil's one-time president from 2003 to 2010, is out of prison and back on the campaign trail. Lula is staging a political comeback and is soaring in the polls in Brazil against incumbent Jair Bolsonaro with a nickname of his own, Trump of the Tropics. Bolsonaro struck a Trumpian populist nerve before, but with Lula, the leftist leader, now cleared to run for office again following a U.S.-backed corruption bust known as Operation Car Wash, Lula has a bone to pick with the U.S. DOJ and the Securities and Exchange Commission, who took part in an elaborate international investigation which many Brazilians viewed as politically motivated, some even calling it American interference in their domestic affairs. Meanwhile, in Venezuela, home of the world's largest oil reserves, President Nicolas Maduro won a second term, survived an assassination attempt, and remains president after what most of the world deems a coup attempt by the West, with the U.S. and U.K. choosing to recognize former parliamentarian Juan Guaido instead as the president. Now, this was bipartisan recognition on the part of American politicians, but as the U.S. gasoline prices began to skyrocket in April of 2022, the U.S. seemed to abandon Guaido and sent a delegation to effectively ask the Maduro administration for help with oil supplies. But that visit didn't go as the Biden administration had hoped. So when the U.S. hosted the Summit of the Americas this year in Los Angeles, they left a few key Latin countries off the invite list, like Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba. Now, this party faux pas not boding well across the southern nations with key countries like Mexico turning down Biden's invite. What then is plan B for the Biden administration in dealing with this new hostility from its southern neighbors? And joining us to discuss this very fluid relationship between the U.S. and South America, let's bring in Dr. Enrique Rivera. He's a historian and author of the new book, The Untold History of Capitalism with International Press. Enrique, good to see you. Thank you for joining us. First, I'd like your read on the upcoming Brazilian elections.
It's huge. It's a huge deal. So Bolsonaro has been a bit of a difficult figure to peg. He's an admirer of Trump. And so when Trump was in office, there was a certain affinity there. But there were some indications that that he was kind of a counter-hegemonic figure. But in the end of the day, kind of as in the history of Latin America, right-wing figures have tended to follow the dictates of Washington. And so in the end of the day, he did end up doing that. And so he was a major ally in regards to cutting off relations with Venezuela, which was a principal aim of the U.S. government to isolate Venezuela, Brazil's largest country in Latin America, both in geographical space as well as in population. And so they also supported the U.S.-backed coup in Bolivia a couple of years ago. And they've even offered, Bolsonaro personally just offered political asylum for Jeanine Añez, who was the head figure of the coup in Bolivia. And so Lula has always kind of been a divisive figure within the U.S. Political establishment. He's been kind of seen as, when he started out, he was certainly seen as kind of a reformer, someone that could be worked with. But I think his forays into launching these, spearheading these international movements like BRICS and UNASUR, ALBA, etc. Lula kind of, his true colors as basically a practical anti-imperialist came through. And then so the hardliners in Washington certainly don't see his coming to office with favor. It's going to be an interesting situation. Lula has a bone to pick, as you mentioned, with the United States. He's calling out the United States on NATO's aggression against Russia, which spurred the invasion of Ukraine, so it's going to be an interesting thing. We're going to see how it plays out.
Yeah, Lula, last I checked, he has consistently been polling in double digits ahead of Bolsonaro. So if Lula does indeed win as anticipated, can the U.S. mend relations with Lula? I mean, I know they helped throw him in prison and all of that, but especially since he recently issued those strong words against the U.S. and the sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Russia. You know, he actually told Time magazine that these sanctions are now hurting the entire world. So with that said, I mean, can the Biden administration make amends with Lula?
Well, I think that the U.S., as they do, I think they're going to take multiple prong approaches. I think the White House and the State Department are certainly going to be saying nice things publicly, while behind closed doors, they are certainly going to be continuing to fund opposition to Lula and certainly going to be trying to get him out of office. I think that Lula himself, I think he's beyond the point of where he thinks that he can rely on the West as a partner. I think that he does seem to realize that that the U.S.'s perceived interests really go against the reality of the interests of the people of the United States and certainly those of Brazil. And so I think the cat's out of the bag as far as he is concerned. But he is a practical politician. He is going to be limited by what exactly he can do. His strong polling numbers come because he's the most popular political figure in Brazil, but he's also casted a wide net politically, and he's brought more moderate forces into his tent. And so people that are more amenable to the United States. And so it's going to be a balancing act for him.
Now, what about the Summit of the Americas? The summit, you know, is still fairly young in its tenure, but it's meant to be a summit for countries in the Western Hemisphere to openly and freely discuss issues at hand. The Biden administration left out Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba from the invite list. And then this led to a cascade of other leaders either declining the invite altogether or sending, you know, perhaps even worse, sending some lower ranking official in the president's place. What was the read of the summit to you? And because you're there in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it was a disaster. Well, the official summit was a disaster. Interestingly, there was a parallel people's summit that was attended by thousands of people. which was organized by various grassroots political organizations in the United States, and also saw delegations from Venezuela, from Cuba. They made their way to the People's Summit, which was a much more celebrated event than the official summit. The summit was a disaster. It really could be seen as a turning point. Historically, because the fact that Mexico refused to attend because of the U.S.'s blacklisting of the three countries you mentioned is a huge deal. I mean, Mexico has been in the U.S.'s pocket for about 90 years now, until López Obrador, who's actually a Lula-type figure. And it's interesting to bring those parallels to him, because you see that balancing act in the United States. They say nice things publicly, but in behind closed doors, man, they can't wait to get rid of this guy. But the thing is, the times have changed. Mexico's a big country with a big economy, and so is Brazil. And so the days of the United States, you know, picking and choosing leaders and moving chessboards according to their designs, those days are largely over. Not to say that they're not trying and they don't have certain successes, they do, but their power is just so much more limited than it used to be. And so I think you can look at this summit as really a turning point in U.S.-Latin American relations. You know, Mexico refused to go, Honduras refused to go. These are two countries that were, you know, Honduras especially has been virtually a U.S. colony for the most of the 20th and 21st centuries. So huge blows to the United States and to the reputation internationally.
Yeah, now some of these states that you just rattled off right there, let's keep our eye on that, because we cannot talk about U.S. relations in South America without discussing the School of the Americas, or WISC, or whatever they're branding it as nowadays, WIMSEC maybe. Graduates from this U.S. military training program have proven to be, Enrique, some of the most violent, the cruelest dictators seen in Latin America, going as far back as the 1950s. The U.S. intervention in Guatemala in the 1950s has shifted the political landscape there for the rest of the 20th century. So what are your final thoughts on SOA and how the U.S. continues to interfere in Latin American domestic issues by continually bringing in these military leaders?
Yeah, I mean, SOA, and its various incarnations have been disastrous for the region. I actually just taught a course at UCLA. I'm in LA, as you mentioned, this past quarter. And I told students, look, there's absolutely, we went through the U.S. support, the dirty wars in South America, the civil wars, in Central America in the 80s. And then we compared those situations with human rights today in Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua. And there really is no comparison at all. I mean, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua are countries. Nicaragua today was a bit different during the Civil War. But these aren't places where you see disappearances, where you see massacres, and where you see genocides. The United States has actively supported, provided intel, trained through the School of the Americas, and overseen operations of torture, of massacres, and of genocides, the worst being in 1982, 1983, U.S.-backed dictator Rios Montt in Guatemala, the extermination of over 200,000 indigenous people, systematic extermination of 200,000 people. This was under the watchful eye of the United States. And in fact, Elliot Abrams, not too long ago, when being grilled by Alain Omar, had to defend his statement that, well, it was worth it. You know, the bloodshed was worth it. My mother's home country of El Salvador, there's the Mozote massacre, tens of thousands of civilians taken out of their homes and massacred by U.S.-trained military officials. Children, thousands of children slaughtered. So it's really been a disaster. To say that the United States, the excuse that the United States says that they are getting involved in U.S. Latin American affairs because of human rights is not anything that can be held up by any evidence. It's quite the contrary.
Yeah, I would have to agree. It looks like the evidence on the ground shows that it's exactly the opposite of what they're presenting to us. Dr. Enrique Rivera, thank you so much for sharing your expert insight with us today. I look forward to talking with you again, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks, Manila.
And next, as U.S.-South America relations sour, BRICS members are expanding their influence. When we return, we'll take a look at how China and Russia are seizing the opportunities arising from American errors down south.
Bye. I'll look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence or its own existence.
I've actually found safety in the embrace of Nazism as a Jew. All of a sudden, you're placed in a position where, hey, I can defend myself now. I don't have to be afraid anymore. On one hand, I'm terrified that they're going to find out I'm Jewish. But on the other, I think it's so far away.
I distinctly remember my mom sitting me down one night and her saying, John, they're going to hurt you. One guy punched me behind my ear, and I heard somebody shout, now!
And the rest came, and the punches just started flying.
And somebody shouted out, die, Jew boy, die. And at that point, I knew there's no coming back.
And I remember I had an Indian doctor. They came in and looked at me and said, there's no medical reason why you should be alive. You need to find something to believe in.
John's story is a story of hope, a story of victory, and whatever I can do to help him, I would do.
Жизнь изменилась кардинально.
If you speak Russian, keep your voice down while out and about.
Ну, иногда приходилось врать просто в силу страха какого-то.
Don't put your homeland symbols on display.
Все, что русскоязычное, то отторгается и подвергается нападкам.
Don't talk to strangers.
Обиди сюда, Что? Чтобы подошли москали.
Avoid noisy gatherings and rallies.
Меня, по сути, назвали фашистом. И, в принципе, меня называют по сей день так называемым термином «рашист».
Even your colleagues and perhaps also your friends think you're guilty because you're Russian.
Они начинают говорить о том, что мы вас найдем, мы вас знаем всех в лицо, ходите, оглядывайтесь.
Ответственность коллективная, даже вот детям достается. Были избиения детей, когда действительно ребенок попал в больницу, и об этом сообщили полиции, то есть это все вышло на официальный уровень.
The Biden administration struggles to find its footing in South America. China and Russia, on the other hand, are expanding their reach and their influence across the global South. The two BRICS nations are looking to add Argentina to the bloc, which would give South America two members from that continent. For Russia, it's not the candidate state who is the biggest economic ally in South America. It's actually Brazil. While neither Brazil nor Argentina joined the U.S. in sanctions against Moscow, Jair Bolsonaro actually asked the WTO to allow his country to continue trading fertilizer with Russia, which is needed for soybean production in Brazil. Outside of the bloc, Russia has found allies in Venezuela and Nicaragua. Meanwhile, China is already the continent's top trading partner. In 2019, Chinese investments in the continent exceeded $13 billion, and the trade between the LAC zone, that is the Latin American and Caribbean, with China topped $300 billion. So already 18 of 33 Latin countries have signed up to be part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. But Southcom seems to find this growing relationship with China quite disturbing and paints a nefarious picture about Beijing's intentions. And here to discuss the number of business deals happening below the equator is Juan Ricardo Ortega. He's an economist and has worked for a number of Colombian government agencies and international banks. Juan, thank you so much for being with us. First, let's talk about SOUTHCOM, the U.S. military's command overseeing South America, finding that Russia and China's relationships in the region, a little bit unnerving, to put it lightly. Historically, the U.S. was the dominant force in the region, both militarily and economically. But over the last decade, we are seeing a shift. Why?
Because China is willing to invest. You know, the social debt in Latin America is enormous. You can perfectly see that in the political shift all over the continent. You are seeing leftist governments from Chile all the way to Mexico. And the Chinese are willing to invest significantly and to lend resources. And unfortunately, the U.S. have withdrew. And regarding climate change, there's been very strong positions against gas and methane and oil. And these are the main staples that provide the strong currency from Latin America. And if the international banks are not willing to fund these projects and the Chinese are, it's very difficult to ask these societies to cut their main source of income just for a bigger debate at international level in an agenda that Latin America actually has very little to say. No, the global impact on carbon emissions of Latin America is minimal. So why should it be the one that cuts its main source of income at this point in time? That's why China has and will play a very significant role in the region coming forward.
Yeah, it makes sense to go where the money is. Now, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba were left off Joe Biden's invite list for the Summit of the Americas this year, as it was the U.S. turn to host. Was this predicated, do you think, Juan, on their friendly relations with Russia?
Most likely. You've seen the overt actions on behalf of the Nicaraguan government towards Russia. They have a big investment in a planes airport that can land bombers that would feed the ones that Russia has. They've been clearly against most of the region's values regarding democracy and transparent and open elections, and the same in Venezuela. And the Russian support for those authoritarian governments have been one of the reasons why they've been able to sustain the current systems that are totally against the democratic values the U.S. preaches in the region.
And China's huge footprint in South America is obviously undeniable, as you had pointed out. Is the U.S. DOD being paranoid about Beijing's influence and their motives in Latin America?
I think there are practical reasons why China is looking at the region. One of their main concerns is having sources of foodstuffs, and Latin America is very rich on that regard. No, we have cattle, we have chicken, we have soybeans, and most of the foodstuffs that the Chinese people might need can be sourced from Latin America, and that gives Latin America an advantage. And some of the raw materials that China lacks can be found in Latin America, as it was the case of lithium in Mexico, or is the case of gold in Colombia, or iron from Brazil. So you have one of the countries that have some of the key inputs for the Chinese economy, and it makes a lot of sense for those relationships to go into a stronger ties and deeper economic interrelationship between China and Latin America. And unfortunately, the U.S. has taken a step back, and if there is a void, it always will be filled.
Yeah, that is how capitalism works, isn't it? Now, does the U.S. somehow feel entitled to this, you know, hegemonic rule in the Western Hemisphere, despite critics saying the U.S. has the worst history in destabilizing governments in Latin America?
In the case of Colombia, it's different. I must say that they were extremely constructive in allowing Colombia to strengthen its institution and being able to rebuild after many years of internal conflict, and the support of the U.S. was critical. Back in the 70s, for sure, the U.S. had nefarious influence both in Chile and Guatemala and probably even Nicaragua. But in later times, I would say they've been more constructive, and they have very strong values regarding liberty, freedom of speech, open democracy, capitalistic markets, and that could change because for the Chinese, those are not all the same priorities. They care more about the economic prosperity and the economic interrelationships than human rights or democracy. And that for the U.S. is a concern. And definitely there is a shift regarding some of these issues in the region.
Yes, it definitely sounds like different goals from two different countries here, two different world leaders. Last thing, Juan, what are your projections about Latin America and the direction they will move in the 21st century? Will they be moving towards the east and away from the U.S.?
The Chinese influence is going to grow significantly. All the investments regarding electric vehicles, public transport, trains, the Chinese have a leadership, and even some of the key infrastructures might be in the electric sector, where they have very big investments in Peru, in Chile, in Brazil, and they're going to be looking at Mexico and Central America as well. And you don't see the U.S. fighting to invest or to participate in these economies. So the Chinese are going to be the ones taking the lead, and that economic integration will give them political leverage. So for sure, the region is going to be moving towards the east very quickly and probably very significantly.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot we're going to see coming out of the new BRICS unions and all the people getting added to BRICS, and excited to see what that will bring for the future in the 21st century with Latin America. Thank you so much, economist Juan Ricardo Ortega. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. An honor being with you. Have a great day.
And that is going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.